Defining the Problem of Evil. The first talk in a series on the problem of evil was presented by Jack Crabtree on May 6, 2012, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. The notes mentioned in this talk are in handout number 1 in this series.
This was the first in a series of talks that I'm giving at Reformation Fellowship on the problem of evil. When this particular talk was given live, the tape recording equipment did not work correctly, so the first 15 to 20 minutes of the lecture didn't get recorded. So what I would like to do here is just sort of report to you in this brief memo what it was that I covered during those 10 to 15 minutes. You will find an outline, a written outline that you can download, but let me fill in the written outline a little bit so that you have a better idea of what I actually covered during this time. I began by commenting how this fits into the other teaching that I've been doing at Reformation Fellowship. I'm in the middle of two series, one called Biblical Philosophy, the Worldview and Message of the Bible, or Why Jesus Would Not Be a Christian, and the other is on Is the Bible Trustworthy? This brief lecture series that I want to do is sort of related to both of those series. On the one hand, we talked extensively last fall about what I call divine determinism and the particular view of God as the author of all reality and therefore as the one who determines all reality according to a script that he has predetermined. And one of the problems, of course, that divine determinism raises is how do we account for and how do we think about the evil in the world and the nature and extent of the evil in the world if God really is the one who's responsible for literally everything that occurs. So to that extent, this fits into the series on biblical philosophy because this is a very important issue, a very important objection that could be raised to the view of God that I've been propounding in that series. It's also related to the other series, Is the Bible Trustworthy? Responding to Bart Ehrman, because Bart Ehrman, in his literature, went from being a fundamentalist Christian to, I believe now, is an agnostic or atheist, and the basis for him deciding that he's an agnostic or an atheist largely has to do with the problem of evil. And as he looks at the Bible, he doesn't see any real coherent and useful answer to the problem of evil in the scripture. So this is a response to Bart Ehrman because one of the major problems that he has with the Bible as a trustworthy document, as the Word of God, is that it can't account for the evil in the world. So this is a brief lecture series that could be integrated into either of the other two series that I've been giving. So what I did in the talk when I was giving it live is that I defined what I call biblical divine determinism. Biblical divine determinism is on the one hand divine determinism, but it's also a belief in divine goodness. That from the biblical perspective, God is the author of all reality. He determines every aspect of everything that is and everything that occurs, just like the author of a novel would be in control of everything that occurs in that novel. So on the one hand, I think the Bible teaches divine determinism. But on the other hand, the Bible is quite clear, I think, that God is good. He's purely good. And he doesn't have the least little hint of evil in his being. I think the way James puts it is that God is the Father of lights in whom there is not even the least hint of deviation. The next thing I did is then go on to define what philosophers call the problem of evil. The problem of evil looks out at the world and looks at all the evil and suffering and pain that's out there, all the injustice, all the oppression, everything undesirable and negative that you could see out there that somebody might call evil. And not just the fact that it exists, but the nature of the evil that exists and the extent of the evil that exists in the world. And the problem of evil is, how can a good God, who determines everything and therefore fully has it within his power to control reality. Why would that God, who can both shape reality and is a good God, create a reality that contains the amount and kind of evil that we see out in the world that we live in? And the suggestion that's made in face of the so-called problem of evil is that in view of the nature and extent of the evil that's in the world, it really is not reasonable to believe that God is both good and the cause of everything that occurs. So it's a direct rebuttal, if you will, to divine determinism, the view of God that I have been presenting in my teaching in the last series. Or in other words, it's a direct attack against what I've called biblical divine determinism, because either, in view of the evil that's in the world, either divine determinism is wrong, and God doesn't cause everything that occurs, or divine goodness is wrong, and God is not actually good, but has some evil in him. But in any case, the suggestion is that given the nature and extent of evil in the world, they can't both be true, that divine determinism is true, and that God is good. One or the other of them has to be wrong, and maybe both of them are wrong. Or, on the other hand, some people might use the problem of evil not to really attack the philosophical legitimacy of biblical divine determinism. They may be willing to say, okay, I'll grant you, God causes everything, and if you want to call him good, you can call him good, but the suggestion is, it is unacceptable, even morally unacceptable, that you and I should submit to such a God, that we should submit to the God who has shaped reality such that it contains the kind and nature of evil that the world actually contains. Then I went on to point out that the problem of evil then becomes the basis for what's called the argument from evil, typically a philosophical argument. It can be an argument for atheism. Atheists are very fond of the argument from evil as being the reason that they would give for why they don't believe God exists. But more importantly and more directly relevant to the talks that I've been giving is the argument from evil would be an argument against biblical divine determinism. It's an argument against the claim that the Bible advocates both divine determinism and divine goodness. And that argument would be an argument that's made by Christians, theists, people who believe in the Bible and who believe in God, but who are adamantly opposed to the view of God and the view of God's relationship to created reality that I've been proposing, the view that I call biblical divine determinism. And their contention would be the nature of the evil in the world doesn't permit me to believe in divine determinism and in divine goodness. And usually they would go on to say, since we know that God is good, therefore divine determinism must be wrong and has to be wrong. So, Jack, you can't propose divine determinism in the way that you have. But perhaps even more problematic than the philosophical argument from evil is the way the problem of evil is exploited, not by philosophers, but usually by literary types, novelists, poets perhaps, artists of various kinds, who will make a psycho-emotional, very compelling psycho-emotional appeal to us as human beings to refuse to acknowledge God in the light of the evil world that he has created and that he's orchestrating. I believe that the recording that follows will take up right in the middle of this point. I argue that it's advanced in literature, and so I have Catherine read a passage called Rebellion out of Dostoevsky's novel The Brothers Karamazov. This passage that she's about to read is just one of the most chilling and forceful, compelling appeals for a human being to rebel against God, to refuse to give God any honor in view of the fact that he allows especially children to suffer in this world. So that's where the tape will take off now, and I hope this little introduction has set the stage clearly enough.
You not only have the argument evil, but you have the problem of evil, as the basis for a psycho-emotionally compelling, and I'm choosing my words carefully there, not an intellectually compelling, a psycho-emotionally compelling appeal to refuse to acknowledge God. And it'll be critical. I mean, the most important thing I can do this morning is to make that distinction for you and help you understand the distinction. I'm going to be able to dispose of the philosophical argument from evil pretty quickly. It's a lousy argument. It doesn't work. You have to assume your conclusion in the premises. It's a classic logical fallacy. So I can dispose of that relatively quickly. But that's not where most people live. Most people are not affected by the problem of evil because of a philosophical argument. Most people are affected by the problem of evil because it is psycho-emotionally compelling. It gets under your skin and motivates you. It fans the flames of your rebellion. Absolutely pours fuel on the fire of your rebellion. And you find welling up within you, yeah, I don't need to bow the knee to him. And there's one classic passage that is all about this, and I have old poor eyes, so I've asked Catherine to come and read it as she comes up. Let me just say a few words about this. I find this a very disturbing passage, so I'll just warn you. And if you want to leave, I don't blame you. It's a very disturbing passage. There are two brothers interacting in this passage, Ivan Karamazov and Alyosha Karamazov. Ivan is a skeptic. Ivan is rejecting the Christian faith. Alyosha is studying to be a priest in the Russian Orthodox Church. This conversation is a collision between their two perspectives here. The part of the chapter leading up to the part that Catherine will read is just a litany of, he decides to focus on cruelty to children. And he gives one after another cases of where children have been treated cruelly. And this is just the last one in a whole series of issues. And I think the rest of it will speak for itself.
Kind of a long passage, so stick with me here. So we're jumping in right, as he said, right as Ivan is talking about this last example, telling a story of an occasion. It was in the darkest days of serfdom, back at the beginning of the century. There was a general at the beginning of the century, a general with high connections and a very wealthy landowner, the sort of man, indeed, even then they seemed to have been very few, who, on retiring from the army, feels all but certain that his service has earned him the power of life and death over his subjects. There were such men in those days. So this general settled on his estate of 2,000 souls, swaggered around, treated his lesser neighbors as his spongers and buffoons. He had hundreds of dogs in his kennels, and nearly 100 handlers, all in livery, all on horseback. And so one day, a house serf, a little boy, only 8 years old, threw a stone while he was playing and hurt the paw of the general's favorite hound. "Why is my favorite dog limping?" It was reported to him that this boy had thrown a stone at her and hurt her paw. "So it was you." The general looked the boy up and down. "Take him." They took him. Took him from his mother and locked him up for the night. In the morning, at dawn, the general rode out in full dress for the hunt, mounted on his horse, surrounded by spongers, dogs, handlers, huntsmen, all on horseback. The house serfs are gathered for their edification, the guilty boy's mother in front of them all. The boy is led out of the lockup, a gloomy, cold, misty autumn day, a great day for hunting. The general orders them to undress the boy. The child is stripped naked. He shivers. He's crazy with fear. He doesn't dare make a peep. "Drive him," the general commands. The huntsmen shout, "Run, run!" The boy runs. "Sick him!" screams the general, and looses the whole pack of wolfhounds on him. He hunted him down before his mother's eyes, and the dogs tore the child to pieces. I believe the general was later declared incompetent to administer his estates. Well, what to do with him? Shoot him? Shoot him for our moral satisfaction? Speak, Alyosha. "Shoot him," Alyosha said softly, looking up at his brother with a sort of pale, twisted smile. "Bravo!" Ivan yelled in a sort of rapture. "If even you say so, then, a fine monk you are. See what a little devil is sitting in your heart, Alyosha Karamazov?" "What I said is absurd, but..." "That's just it, that but," Ivan was shouting. "I tell you, novice, that absurdities are all too necessary on earth. The world stands on absurdities, and without them perhaps nothing at all would happen. We know what we know." "What do you know?" "I don't understand anything," Ivan went on, as if in delirium, "and I no longer want to understand anything. I want to stick to the fact. I made up my mind long ago not to understand. If I wanted to understand something, I would immediately have to betray the fact, but I've made up my mind to stick to the fact." "Why are you testing me?" Alyosha exclaimed with a rueful strain. "Will you finally tell me?" "Of course I'll tell you. That's just what I've been leading up to. You are dear to me, and I don't want to let you slip. I won't give you up to your Zosima." Ivan was silent for a moment. His face suddenly became very sad. "Listen to me. I took children only so as to make it more obvious. About all the other human tears that have soaked the whole earth through, from crust to core, I don't say a word. I've purposely narrowed down my theme. I am a bedbug, and I confess in all humility that I can understand nothing of why it's all arranged as it is. So people themselves are to blame. They were given paradise, they wanted freedom, and stole fire from heaven, knowing that they would become unhappy. So why do you pity them? Oh, with my pathetic, earthly, Euclidean mind, I know only that there is suffering, that none are to blame, that all things follow simply and directly one from another, that everything flows and finds its level. But that is all just Euclidean gibberish, of course I know that, and of course I cannot consent to live by it. What do I care that none are to blame, and that I know it? I need retribution, otherwise I will destroy myself. And retribution, not somewhere and sometime in infinity, but here and now on earth, so that I see it myself. I have believed, and I want to see it for myself. And if I am dead by that time, let them resurrect me, because it will be too unfair if it all takes place without me. Is it possible that I have suffered so that I, together with my evil deeds and sufferings, should be manure for someone's future harmony? I want to see with my own eyes the hind lie down with the lion, and the murdered man rise up and embrace his murderer. I want to be there when everyone suddenly finds out what it was all for. All religions in the world are based on this desire, and I am a believer. But then there are the children, and what am I going to do with them? That is the question I cannot resolve. For the 100th time, I repeat, there are hosts of questions, but I have taken only the children, because here, what I need to say is irrefutably clear. Listen, if everyone must suffer in order to buy eternal harmony with their suffering, pray tell me, what have the children got to do with it? It's quite incomprehensible why they should have to suffer, and why they should buy harmony with their suffering. Why do they get thrown on the pile to manure someone's future harmony with themselves? I understand solidarity in sin among men. Solidarity in retribution I also understand. But what solidarity in sin do little children have? And if it is really true that they, too, are in solidarity with their fathers and all their fathers' evil doing, that truth is certainly not of this world and is incomprehensible to me. Some joker will say, perhaps, that in any case the child will grow up and have time enough to sin. But there's this boy who didn't grow up but was torn apart by dogs at the age of 8. Oh, Alyosha, I'm not blaspheming. I do understand how the universe will tremble when all in heaven and under the earth merge in one voice of praise, and all that lives and has lived cries out, "Just art thou, O Lord, for thy ways are revealed." Oh, yes, when the mother and the torturer whose hounds tore her son to pieces embrace each other, and all three cry out with tears, "Just art thou, O Lord." Then, of course, the crown of knowledge will have come, and everything will be explained. But there is the hitch. That is what I cannot accept. And while I am on earth, I hasten to take my own measures. You see, Alyosha, it may well be that if I live until that moment, or rise again in order to see it, I myself will perhaps cry out with all the rest, looking at the mother embracing her child's tormentor. Just art thou, O Lord. But I do not want to cry out with them. While there's still time, I hasten to defend myself against it, and therefore I absolutely renounce all higher harmony. It is not worth one little tear of even that one tormented child who beat her chest with her little fists and prayed to dear God in a stinking outhouse with her unredeemed tears. Not worth it because her tears remained unredeemed. But they must be redeemed, otherwise there can be no harmony. But how will you redeem them? Is it possible? Can they be redeemed by being avenged? But what do I care if they are avenged? What do I care if the tormentors are in hell? What can hell set right here if these ones have already been tormented? And where is the harmony if there is hell? I want to forgive. I want to embrace. I don't want more suffering. And if the suffering of children goes to make up the sum of suffering needed to buy truth, then I assert beforehand that the whole of truth is not worth such a price. I do not, finally, want the mother to embrace the tormentor who let his dogs tear her son to pieces. She dare not forgive him. Let her forgive him for herself if she wants to. Let her forgive the tormentor her immeasurable maternal suffering, but she has no right to forgive the suffering of her child who was torn to pieces. She dare not forgive the tormentor, even if the child himself were to forgive him. And if that is so, if they dare not forgive, then where is the harmony? Is there in the whole world a being who could and would have the right to forgive? I don't want harmony. For love of mankind, I don't want it. I want to remain with unrequited suffering. I'd rather remain with my unrequited suffering and my unquenched indignation, even if I am wrong. Besides, they have put too high a price on harmony. We can't afford to pay so much for admission, and therefore I hasten to return my ticket. And it is my duty, if only as an honest man, to return it as far ahead of time as possible, which is what I am doing. It's not that I don't accept God, Alyosha. I just most respectfully return him the ticket. That is rebellion, Alyosha said softly, dropping his eyes. Rebellion? I don't like hearing such a word from you, Ivan said with feeling. One cannot live by rebellion, and I want to live. Tell me, straight out, I call on you. Answer me. Imagine that you yourself are building the edifice of human destiny with the object of making people happy in the finale, of giving them peace and rest at last. But for that, you must inevitably and unavoidably torture just one tiny creature, that same child who was beating her chest with her little fist, and raise your edifice on the foundation of her unrequited tears. Do you agree to be the architect on such conditions? Tell me the truth. No, I would not agree, Alyosha said softly. And can you admit the idea that the people for whom you are building would agree to accept their happiness on the unjustified blood of a tortured child, and having accepted it, to remain forever happy? No, I cannot admit it. Brother, Alyosha said suddenly, his eyes beginning to flash, you asked just now if there is in the whole world a being who could and would have the right to forgive. But there is such a being, and he can forgive everything, forgive all and for all, because he himself gave his innocent blood for all and for everything. You've forgotten about him, but it is on him that the structure is being built, and it is to him that they will cry out, Just art thou, O Lord, for thy ways have been revealed. Ah, yes, the only sinless one in his blood. No, I have not forgotten about him. On the contrary, I've been wondering all the while why you hadn't brought him up for so long, because in discussions your people usually trot him out first thing. You know, Alyosha, don't laugh. I composed a poem once about a year ago. If you can waste 10 more minutes on me, I'll tell it to you. You wrote a poem? Oh, no, I didn't write it, Yvonne laughed. I've never composed two lines of verse in my whole life. But I made up this poem and memorized it. I made it up in great fervor. You'll be my first reader, I mean listener. Why, indeed, should an author lose even one listener? Yvonne grinned. Shall I tell it or not? I'm listening carefully, said Alyosha. My poem is called The Grand Inquisitor. An absurd thing, but I want you to hear it.
Alyosha gets right to the heart of the matter when, in just one word, that's rebellion, he says to Yvonne. But what we're going to see is, as long as the problem of evil is thrown at us, or if we allow it in, I mean, what do most Christians do? They don't even allow the problem in. And one of the reasons I wanted Catherine to read that is that, you know, when left to ourselves and we face the evil in the world, we tend to just shut it out. But that's why we have the theology that we have, is because we haven't faced reality. We haven't faced the facts. We haven't faced the world as it actually is. If our faith is true, it has to be able to explain and take into account the world as it actually is. So we have to let it in and not just block it out. Well, that's what Yvonne is trying to get Alyosha to do, and is deal with the facts. Now, but although he's trying to get him to deal with the facts, Yvonne himself is simply in rebellion against God, but he knows how to play on that rebellion. And I think that's what every one of us feel when we read that. I mean, you can't help but at some level it gets that little hook in you that says, yeah, what a lousy world you're creating, God. What a lousy world. And if you feel that, join the club. I mean, it just, I think that's really natural that we would feel that way. But if any of us are going to be believers and remain believers and live as believers in this world, live in as believers in the God of the Bible, we have to confront that problem of evil and understand it from the perspective that I think the Bible itself would take on it. Now, what no rebuttal to the problem of evil is ever going to be able to do is do an end run around rebellion. If you choose to look at the problem of evil and hate God for it, no argument in the world can prevent you from choosing to hate God. I can't do that. It's not, your hatred of God is not a conclusion, and therefore I can't rebut or show you the fallacy of your conclusion, because it's not a conclusion that you're reaching, it's a response that you're making, it's a choice that you're making. Well, an argument cannot block you from making the choice. And I'm saying you, but anybody in the world. So just going on in my notes then, we B3B, there's a distinction between an argument not to submit to God and a compelling appeal not to submit to God. Yvonne isn't even attempting to make an argument in that passage. He's quite willing to concede all of the philosophical explanations about how this all fits together, some greater harmony in the end, and this harmony that God is going to build is out of the ashes of the suffering of this one child or Jesus or whoever. He's quite willing to concede any philosophical point that you might make about how all this may work, how all this may fit together, how all of this might be rational. He will grant you all that. He's not arguing the case that you have to not submit to God because it's irrational. What he is doing is saying, remember that line, I choose to turn in my ticket. That's just simply a choice. I don't find this acceptable. I don't choose to accept this. I don't want to accept this. I frankly don't like it. I just don't like the created reality that he's giving. Well, it's important to make a distinction. See the next point. The failure to understand this distinction a distinction between an argument not to submit to God and an appeal not to submit to God. If you don't make that distinction, that creates a lot of confusion, I think, in people's minds. Because, as I just said, one could successfully rebut the philosophical argument against biblical divine determinism without in the least motivating a person to submit to God. An argument can only demonstrate what is reasonable and therefore most what is likely true. An argument cannot make one believe, nor can it make one choose to act in accord with what is true. So no philosophical argument that establishes the rationality of believing in the goodness of God can ever make a person willing to believe that God is good and willing to like God and willing to submit to God. No argument can do that. But, and here's where the problem lies, if an argument fails to remove a person's dislike for God and a person's dislike for what God has caused and how he's running reality, that doesn't mean that the argument has failed to successfully rebut the argument from evil. Nothing in the Bible would suggest that we must like what God is doing in our lives and in created reality. It's important to understand that. The Bible is not asking me to like it or to even like God from the standpoint of what he's doing. In fact, I would argue if we liked the suffering and evil that we see in the world, then that's perverse. There's something very ungodly and wrong with us if we look at what God is doing in the world and the suffering and the evil that he's creating and like it, then there's something very desperately wrong with us right there. Of course we don't like it. It's evil. At least the evil part is evil. Well, we'll have to make a distinction between evil and suffering. Those get blended together in most people's minds, and it's important to keep those distinct. I'll deal with those separately. But the evil in the world should be abhorrent to us, even though God is the author of it. God is not asking me to look at the evil in the world and say, God authored that, therefore I love it, therefore I like it. No, he's authoring evil for me to hate. He's authoring evil for him to hate. He's authoring evil that any good being would hate. So not liking it is what we ought to be doing, not something we should be getting over. But if a person chooses to hate God because he does not like reality as it's going down, no philosophical argument could possibly convince him not to hate God. It's fallacious, of course, to hate God because you don't like the reality he's created. I will show and I will argue. But it's easy for someone to make that choice and make that determination. I'm going to hate God because I don't like what he's doing. When a rebuttal to the problem of evil fails to remove a person's dislike for what God has brought about, and as I said, no argument could remove his dislike, but when it has failed to remove his dislike, the person can then deceive himself into thinking that the failure of the rebuttal to mollify his dislike somehow justifies him in holding God in contempt. Because you haven't satisfied me and turned my dislike of what God is doing into the world into some kind of acquiescence to what God is doing in the world, some kind of liking of what God is doing in the world, therefore I'm justified to hold God in contempt and hate him. That's fallacious. There's nothing about a rebuttal failing to make you like what God is doing that justifies you in choosing to hate him. I hope you can understand that, because that's the critical issue. Many of people have, at least ostensibly, lost their faith on that fallacious move. They go to the theodicies, the arguments for why the evil in the world is not evidence against God's goodness, and they read them and they read them and they read them, and they don't find any of them satisfying. But what they're not finding satisfying is what they're expecting those arguments to do is make them feel better about created reality. Feel better about a guy sicking his dogs on an eight-year-old boy and have them tear him to pieces. I mean, don't find that horrific. Where's the argument to tell me that I don't have to find that horrific? Well, no argument's going to convince you that that's not horrific. And because it doesn't convince you that it's horrific, then you can make the next fallacious move. So to clench my fist and shake it at God and hold him in contempt, I am utterly justified in doing that. Indeed, I am the moral superior. Well, how does that follow? That's what we have to understand. Okay, let me pause for comments or questions.
Thanks for that presentation. I'm definitely mulling over some thoughts about this right now, but thinking about a few things in relation to this. One is, if God wills to will libertarian freedom in certain aspects of created reality, wouldn't that be an exercise of his sovereignty?
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say wills to will libertarian, what was the next?
Certain aspects of libertarian freedom and created reality. Okay. So not that God can't control things, but that...
Now, depending upon what you mean by that, that's my view. Is okay. That what I do in my liberty, what I do in my freedom, God has willed. Now, if what you mean by libertarian is autonomy from God, autonomy from his script, autonomy from his causation, autonomy from his control, then yeah, that's a different view.
Yeah.
So are you saying then, if God wills to grant me autonomy?
Just hypothetically, not necessarily in all aspects. So basically, God could predestine certain things to happen, and he does predestine certain things to happen. But if God in his sovereignty chooses to not predestine every single thing that happens, if he chooses that, then wouldn't that be an exercise of his sovereignty? Hypothetically, at least.
Well, yes. I mean, it would if he could do that. But that's what's critical, and I did talk about this a little bit last fall, but let's go over this again. What I would argue is that would be a logical impossibility for God to do that. It would be akin to God creating something to be uncreated. Mm-hmm. For God to cause something to be uncaused by him, I would argue, is ultimately a logical contradiction and is impossible for even God to do. Mm-hmm. And it would be like, I mean, granted, this is an argument from analogy, and so it's illegitimate, but just as a way of thinking about it, yeah, it would be like a novelist, you know, getting to chapter 4 and saying to the characters, you do 5. You do chapter 5.
Yeah.
That's, I think, what it would be analogous to, because if everything about me, if what it means to be a creature, mm-hmm. if the kind of being that I have is that I am a creation of the very will, mind and will of God himself, and I wouldn't even exist if God didn't will me into the existence in the next second,
yeah.
and everything about who I am and what I am and how I'm operating is willed into existence by God, if that is indeed what it means for us to be a creature, then it's inherently impossible for God to say, be on your own.
Yeah.
You know, you just, the next nanosecond's on you. Take it.
Yeah, I guess perhaps if the author-novel analogy is not totally perfect, would you still have grounds to say that having any kind of freedom that is free from God making me do something, so in the morning I choose what shirt I'm going to wear, I choose what socks I'm going to wear, that kind of freedom, is it necessarily controlled by God? Is God necessarily making me do that the whole time? And why would that be important, I guess, is one thing. Why is it important for God to control my socks?
Okay. Yeah, that sounds silly, but it's not. Let me explain. I was going to make another point first, though. I lost it. Okay. Maybe it'll come back to me. But
okay.
Why is that not? Why would God control the trivial? because anything and everything that happens in reality is connected with other things. Something that might be trivial in and of itself turns out to be incredibly consequential in the grander scheme of things. Let me give you a few examples. There's a great passage in Jonathan Edwards' Freedom of the Will on this, where he makes a great case for how one little trivial change here changes all of history. And it's really true when you think about it. But let me give you a biblical example. Remember when a prophet, I don't know if it's Elijah, I think it might be Elijah, but it may be some other prophet, prophesies that King, is it Ahab? Who's the one that dies and the dogs lick his blood?
Isn't that Ahaz?
Ahaz, yeah. And the prophet, I think it's Elijah, prophesies that you're going to die and the dogs will lick your blood. And so Ahaz is going to outsmart God, right? So he's in an alliance with another king. They swap chariots and clothes, I think, costumes and chariots, so that Ahaz, the other guy looks like Ahaz and Ahaz looks like somebody else. So he's tricked God now. Well, they go into battle, and sure enough, his ploy works. The enemy go chasing the other guy, and Ahaz gets off free. So he's making his way back to the city, just driving down the valley. And on the other side of the hill, separating that valley from another valley, I think it's an enemy soldier, but I don't recall if it's an enemy soldier, just decides at random, for no reason at all, to shoot an arrow in the air. And it goes up over the hill, comes down the valley, and hits him in the only spot of the armor, the only spot where the armor doesn't protect him, in his temple, and he falls over, dies, and bleeds all over the chariot, and the dogs come and lick his blood. Well, notice how you could characterize that soldier's action. Well, God doesn't control everything. I mean, if I just randomly pick up an arrow and shoot it in the sky, God's not in control of that, is he? Well, in that case, he was. What if you decide to wear this color shirt instead of this color shirt? And lo and behold, the color shirt that you pick is exactly the same color as somebody that is that a gang is out to get. And they come by and they see you and they mistake you for a gang member because you're wearing the shirt and they shoot you dead. That was no longer a trivial choice of what color shirt to wear that morning. We don't know. We don't have a perspective on how everything in life fits together such that we could ever declare any choice trivial. Every one of them can be consequential. Some of you know the story that our oldest son choked to death on an almond when he was 2 years old. He choked to death on an almond. Jody was in labor. We had gone to Long's drugstore in Northern California, and we were in the car ready to leave. And Jody said, "Blue Diamond almonds are on sale." Why did I get them? For the life of me, I mean, I don't like Blue Diamond almonds that much. But I just said spontaneously, "Oh, well, we need to get some." I went back in the store. Got out of the car, went back in the store and got some almonds that he ended up sneaking up and taking out of the middle of the seats and filling his mouth full of them. And he choked on one of those almonds. Was that an inconsequential decision on my part? No, of course not. It was incredibly consequential.
So you're saying that God actively predestined the death of your oldest son via almonds?
Right. Absolutely.
Not to sound funny, but... your analogy, yeah, I think...
No,
go ahead.
Does that not make sense?
No, I think that makes sense. Okay. And I think your analogy does make sense. I guess within the context of that analogy, I'm just kind of wondering if we stepped outside of that analogy, is it possible that God controls all sorts of things and that God controls lots of things, in fact, but chooses to not control certain things?
Okay, yeah, that's
Or to not control certain things at certain times.
Yeah, that's the thing that I was going to say.
Per se.
It's critical to understand I'm not arguing from analogy. I'm arguing by analogy. Mm-hmm. And the distinction is this. The argument from analogy is fallacious. I come along and I look at the relationship between an author and a novel, and I decide, well, that's I'm going to say that God's relationship to the creation is like that, and now I'm going to go here for all the information I need to know about how God is related to the world. That would be fallacious, because I can only go there for information if there's an analogy. Well, I can't just declare there to be an analogy out of the blue. I have to know that there's an analogy ahead of time in order for the analogy of the author in the novel to be informative to me about the relationship between God and created reality. Argument by analogy is to say, I know that they're analogous. Now, knowing that they're analogous, this is way more accessible to me and knowable to me than this is. Let me educate myself about the nature of this relationship, author to novel, in order that I can understand the nature of this relationship, God to his creation. My argument for divine determinism is not that authors are different than their characters, therefore God must be different than the creation. My argument is God is different from the creation. I see that in the Bible. And not only is he different from his creation, and he's different from his creation in a particular kind of way, he transcends his creation. So everything in his creation, he's the transcendent cause of everything in his creation. You following me?
Yeah.
And literally in my own thinking, that's the order that it took. I landed on the notion that I can only make sense out of these biblical passages that I'm reading here if God is not just one more cause like all the other causes in the world, but God is a transcendent cause of the things that occur in his reality. Once I had landed there, I kind of threw up my hands and said, well, it's going to be a while before I'm transcendent, so I guess I can't know anything about that. And then one day, walking along, it just dawned on me, that ain't true. We know what it's like to be transcendent. We transcend the works of our imagination. And then got me started thinking about, over here, as far as I got was, I guess the Apostle Paul thinks that God can cause people to freely choose. Well, how can he do that without that being a contradiction? He doesn't cause us to freely choose through manipulation or coercion or any of the ordinary means that people cause other people to do things. He creates the choice in them. That's a different kind of causation. That's a transcendent causation. Well, once I had landed on that, and then I come over here to a novel and I recognize that's exactly the kind of causation that an author uses in writing, in creating, in imagining a story, is he's the transcendent cause of everything that happens in that story. That's why it's not ridiculous for an author to cause a murderer to commit a murder in a novel and then have a trial and convict him. And never once in those novels does the defense attorney makes the case, look, we're in a novel and the author made him do it, you can't blame him.
Yeah, that's right? Cool. I could say a little more about the analogy and the possible perfections or imperfections about it, but I want to get to the last thing that's kind of bothering me. In relation to passages in the Bible, there's definitely passages in Ephesians 1, in Romans 9, certain portions of Isaiah, this part in Samuel where God makes David sin. There's definitely passages that I could go to and accumulate and make a pretty good deduction that God determines everything that ever happens. And so I kind of understand the theological workings of that argument fairly well. Something that does bother me within the biblical context is when I look at certain passages where choice is involved and God relates his feelings with those choices. So for instance, in the situation of Cain and Abel, when Cain is upset with his brother, it says that God comes to Cain and he says, Cain, don't you know if you do well, you will be accepted? But if you don't do well, sin crouches at the door and its desire is to take you. Mm-hmm. And then situations with Isaiah and Israel where God is clearly very pissed off. And, you know, what are you guys doing? I've done everything I can do. Why have you turned against me like this? And yet, you know, within this model of predestination, God's the one making them rebel against him. He's the one ordering their disobedience step by step, detail by detail. And yet, he's pissed off. He's really bothered by their disobedience. And maybe just another example would be in Ezekiel where God is saying, look, I'm looking for a man to stand in the gap, somebody who actually, I think in the context, cares about me and will pray for you, to stand in the gap between me and you. And God says, and there wasn't one. And he clearly seems very upset about it. And yet in this model, God is predestining that there be no man in the gap. And so there's two things that seem to be illegitimated within those passages, if I take this model of predestination that makes me squirm a little bit. One is that God's emotions are unjustified, that God is upset, God gets pissed off, God is mad. There's something in him, he's going to judge you because he's done all that he can do, kind of a thing. Those emotions seem very justified. In fact, kind of what you mentioned earlier about certain views of the will making God into a cartoon, that to me seems to make God into a cartoon. His emotions aren't valuable then. Number two, the second thing that seems illegitimated to me with that model imposed on those passages is the legitimate choice that God is giving, for instance, to Cain. So God gives Cain a choice, and he says, look, if you do well, you'll be accepted. If you don't, sin crouches at the door. And it seems to be a very clear, very cogent choice. One is that you hypothetically could do this, and you hypothetically could do this. And what makes it a choice is that Cain could equally do one or the other. And yet, God's confronting him and saying, look, you need to make the right choice, but ha ha ha, I'm going to make you sin. So those two things bother me. So if you could interact with that a little bit in those passages.
Well, first of all, the emotions. God is a person. And as I'm arguing in biblical divine determinism, he is good and not evil. And as a good God who is not evil, what is his attitude, his emotional response, if you will? What is his attitude or his evaluation of evil? He hates it. He judges it. He condemns it. He rejects it. He is going to destroy it in the end. His wrath against evil comes out of the moral nature of who God is. Does it matter that it's an evil he created? No, because it's evil. Evil is evil whether I created it or didn't, or somebody else created it. Evil is evil. That's why you can get an author having an emotional response to the characters in their book. David, you were talking about, what's her name? The billionaire lady. Yeah, who was crying about killing off one of the characters. Well, why would an author be crying about killing off a character? Because in your imagination, this is a person that you have created, and that particular person you like. And you see the tragedy of a character that you like meeting that kind of fate. That's perfectly understandable to me. And I think that's what we are dealing with God all the time. God has created, everything in my answer to the problem of evil hinges on this. I believe God has created a reality that is a narrative. It's a story, and it has the structure and the logic of a narrative. And we have to understand it that way. Its whole meaning and significance is as a narrative. And that's how the problem of evil is going to be solved, when we understand that it's all about the story God is telling, and it's not about us. Say, I promised you wouldn't like my answer, but that's the obnoxious truth, is that it's not about us. So Yvonne can get all upset because it doesn't suit him. Well, God never created a reality to suit me. It's not about me. He's creating a reality to suit himself. So when we judge the goodness of that reality, we have to ask the question, is it something that's good that suits his purposes? Not does it suit my purposes? And I am totally wandering in.
The second thing that I was concerned that model would illegitimate is choices like Cain.
Okay, same thing there. God doesn't have the option. That's where we started. It's not logically possible for God to give me any other kind of freedom except the freedom that we all recognize and experience as free will, free choice. Nothing in created reality, not the cells of my body, my body chemistry, my genes, nothing is manipulating me and coercing me into do it. I could do A and I could do B. That's the choice before me, and nothing is restraining me from doing A or B. And how is it going to be determined? I need to resolve my own will in my freedom to do that rather than that. Well, that's what God is saying to Cain. The only thing that's going to make you go one way rather than the other is you, Cain. You are the one. And no one's going to twist your arm. No one can make you do it. No one, nothing is causing you to do it. You're going to have to cause yourself to do it. And what are you going to do? This is the right way to go. This is the wrong way to go. Which way are you going to go? So he has this freedom to go one way rather than the other. Now, is it freedom from the script writer, God? Well, no, that's impossible. None of us can be free of God. But when God acts, he doesn't coerce Cain. He creates in Cain Cain's own choice. But it's Cain's choice. But it's Cain's choice created by God. But the reason he's accountable for it is because it belongs to him. Not a brother, not a sister, not the mouse in his pocket. It belongs to him. He's the one who resolved his will to murder, defy God, not believe God, not trust God. He chose that. But he chose it as a creature. Well, as a creature, where does the stuff that happens to us and that makes us who we are come from? From our Creator. So even my free choices are a creation of God creating within me the way I use my freedom to determine my future, my destiny. He creates what I choose.
That makes pretty good sense. Just by way of analogy, if I told you, Jack, don't do this to me. If you do this to me, you're going to burn in hell forever. I don't know. If there was consequences attached to something that I told you, don't do this to me, and yet if I had some sort of power or ability to cause you to do it to me, so I say, don't flip me off, Jack. Don't do it. And in my superpowerness, I make you flip me off. And I say, you know what, Jack? I'm going to burn you in hell forever because you flipped me off. Mm-hmm. And doesn't there seem to be something wrong with that? If I can make you do that, even if it is in some sense from transcendence, I make you do this thing that I have prescribed consequences for. I'm the one causing you to do it and giving you the consequences.
Right. That's the nub of the problem of evil right there.
Yeah.
But poor Satan. I mean, we have to stop and think about this. Unless we are universalists who believe that everybody, everywhere, for all time, throughout all of eternity, is going to enter into a blessed existence for all of eternity, if there is any condemnation at all, God loses. If our criteria is, what's the outcome for us or any one single person? What's the outcome for me? What's the outcome for you? What's the outcome for us? If we judge the goodness of this thing by the outcome, there is no answer to the problem of evil. And that's why I say only divine determinism can answer the problem of evil. nothing else in Christianity, nothing else in Christian theism can answer that problem. Because once you decide to judge it from the outcome, whether or not it was good to do, then if the outcome is bad, God is evil to have done it. And you notice that's the assumption behind your question. Because my answer would be, is going to be, if God makes a rebel rebel against him and then condemns him for his rebellion, that's exactly right. It's exactly what he ought to do.
That's
what right does he have to make a rebel? He's God. He's the creator. He's the storyteller. He's the one authoring this.
Huh? I better let someone else talk into this microphone.
Okay. Is there any other last question? We're about out of time. But.
You made a quick passing reference to someone losing their faith in light of the wrong answer to the problem of evil. Is there a difference between living in disappointment and living? I mean, there must be a difference between living in disappointment, like when you find out your parents aren't perfect, but you're still their kid.
and ponder how a perfect being could come from an imperfect parent. Yeah.
That's a whole new theological debate right there. No, but then there is a difference between the rebellious brother, it's Russian.
Ivan.
Yeah, who goes, aha, gotcha, to God. And someone listening to this who may think, oh, and just be disappointed that God isn't who they thought he was.
Mm-hmm.
This person will live a quiet, sedate willingness to still let God be God, but sort of a disappointed, jaundiced perspective, maybe, whereas this person rebels against God, feeling justified not just in saying he doesn't exist. He exists, and I don't like him, so I'm not going to serve him. Is it possible that this person could actually be experiencing a corrupted faith, but still?
Yeah, no, I think so. What I have in mind are people who will tell you that they just flat out reject Christianity now, and there are such people. But you've put your finger on the issue. My contention, you know, when I say why Jesus would not be a Christian as the subtitle to my series, I'm serious. Christianity believes a false God. And you really see it here on the problem of evil. I can't remember how you put it, but you put it very well, where we're disappointed because God isn't what I thought he was. Well, that is so severe that I actually believed in a different God than the God who actually exists. And my religion was founded on and centered on a belief in a God who is different from the God of the Bible, a God who doesn't exist. In 1 John, John ends his letter, "Little children, guard yourself from idols." And we very much need to guard ourselves from idols. As hard as it may be, and as obnoxious as it may be, and as hard to swallow as it may be, we need to confront the God who really is there in the pages of the Bible and learn to know, love, follow, and serve him, not the God we made up, the God who is untouched by evil, who wants everybody, the outcome for everybody to be great, if only he could. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that we frame it, but we're believing in a God who's not actually the God of the Bible when we think that way. Now, I'm not accusing all those people who believe that false God and who believe in an idol of not being genuine believers. I think many of them are. But in our ignorance, in the name of serving the God of the Bible, we believe in and serve this other God who's not the God of the Bible at all. Well, we need to cut it out. And I need to let you go.